Hey folks, Mark from Unsung, joined by Christopher.
Dr.
Christopher.
Glasses.
Hey,
don't forget it.
Dr. Christopher Glasses.
We are balls deep in one of the most odious subjects that we've covered for a while.
Week two of Turbo Folk. Yes, it's riveting, to be fair, but it is also some of the worst cunts I've ever, literally some of the worst cunts I've ever lived.
Certainly in a musical context.
I don't even think that.
It's just full stop.
Yeah, just full stop.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, absolutely. Some of these people were legit war criminals. So, Unsung Podcast, a lot to get through here. We are paying back into the giant cosmic balance that enables us to spend half the year taking the piss out of people like Biffy Clyro in Health by doing some actual journalism. This is the second week of a very intense subject. You're going to get edumacated though by listening to it. We spent a lot of time doing this. The reason we've done it this way, the reason we've gone into this much depth is because, for example, there's a Vice video out there that covers Turbo Folk in about 12 minutes. And mainly what it does is take the piss out of a bunch of people, make them look stupid, albeit they do a pretty good job of doing that themselves. Make them sound stupid, they also do a good job of that themselves. But it doesn't actually tell you anything about what the fuck was this very complicated story doing, where did it come from, how is it appropriated by this nationalist movement, how did it help enable fucking genocide, like literal genocide attempts in the Balkans in the 90s. So it's a much more complicated thing, and it definitely did not feel right to just quote a bunch of really offensive lyrics and then have a bit of a yuck at it and go, aren't the people from that part of the world fucking mental?
Yeah.
And then piss off back to making fun of weird indie pop. So we're trying to present a fairly nuanced account here of something that is a lot more multi-layered, and yes, it has some bad moments, but it's also got a lot more to it. We did try and lay out some basics of the timeline of the Balkan conflicts, also Tito and his death and how that led to it all collapsing, the rise of neo-folk music at that time. The fact that the communists had tried to squash it because it reminded them of the sort of rural, unsophisticated communities, and so therefore it acquired a little bit of a kind of anti-authoritarian cool. Milosevic came in and he took the exact opposite tact, a bit like Trump. He wanted to court these lesser educated rural communities that were a bit more conservative, and he then directed their ire towards his goals in the various Balkan conflicts when states started to secede from the crumbling Yugoslavia. So it's all very complicated, but what is essential to remember is that this was a genre that grew somewhat organically from a bunch of economic and social factors, migration, rapid industrialization. But this actor, this authoritarian malign state under Milosevic, saw an opportunity to weaponize it. And that's exactly what they did. They weaponized turbo folk music. And from that, we were quoting some lyrics, some of the worst examples in the last episode. Some really, really odious stuff came out, and it did very well. It's really, really popular, especially then at the time, but still today. I mean, there's still millions and millions of plays of some of these tracks. And I would assume they get pulled down, because certainly a number of the ones that I quoted are being removed from YouTube for a long time, and when they do get uploaded they get flagged and removed again. So for a song to be up long enough to get a few million plays, it must be fairly regularly
Prism's on Spotify, mate.
Yeah, that is true. That is true. But I think we went through some of the kind of really sinister kind of minor figures and that. Well, not necessarily minor figures. I mean, that, what do you call them, was number one in the that list of albums. Mm-hmm. But I think we should talk about the queen of turbo folk, Tsetsa. Born Svetlana Riznatovich, she's hailed as the queen of turbo folk by many, though she is not hailed as the originator. Let's be clear, we did mention your man Rambo was the guy who came up with the name, but also the elder stateswoman of turbo folk. We'll get to her shortly. But Tsetsa grew up in a small Serbian village. She performed in the various kafanas, which were basically cafes, music cafes, public kind of gathering points. Her big break came at 13 years of age when her talent caught the attention of a guy called Mirko Kodic. He was a kind of fairly well-known singer and accordion player. By age 15, Tsetsa's debut in her first album, I think I'll try the pronunciation, Zvetak Zanovetak, which sounds like a fucking painkiller, and went on to win at the Lidza Folk Music Festival for the record's eponymous track. Now, we spoke about Tsetsa in the first episode because she quite famously sort of cemented the connection between turbo folk and some of the odious paramilitary, nationalist, genocidal bullshit that it's associated with by marrying Arkan. It was a huge wedding, huge event, really kitschy, really fucking tacky, but it did, in the minds of the Serbian public, really sort of solidify the connection that was already sort of tacitly there. Arkan, how did she meet him, basically? Well, Tsetsa used to perform for soldiers on the front lines, sort of demonstrating her nationalist sentiments anyway. During just such a concert in 93, she met Zeljko Riznatović, Arkan, in other words. In her words, quote, "He was very cute, very handsome and very masculine. I fell in love with him instantly. I respect people who are fighters, who succeed in life, who don't give up, because life is a constant struggle." Arkan was a Serbian career criminal and gangster who'd been operating across Europe in the years prior. He was initially specialising in smuggling, bank robbery, jewellery heists and more. He'd actually escaped multiple prisons out with Serbia. He went back to Serbia on his last escape. As the writer Kira Azile, also on that website, scalar.usc.edu, that we mentioned in the first episode, really good website. As Kira Azile writes, in 1990, Arkan created his own paramilitary group, the Serbian Volunteer Guard, also known as Arkan's Tigers. That's in response to Croatia seceding or announcing it was going to secede from Yugoslavia. Arkan personally led many of the operations that were meant to support the Serbian National Army's efforts. And also, as a militia group, they could do the things that the army technically couldn't do. It's a bit like Wagner and the Russian military. They were able to do things that would have been frowned upon if the state forces were being, if you know, public taxpayer money was being used to do that. The Tigers were active on the Croatian and Bosnian fronts, fighting against other paramilitary forces while killing and deporting Bosniak citizens. Arkan rewarded his top-performing soldiers for results of looting. He and the rest of the force were responsible for multiple acts of torture and genocidal murder in Bosnia and Croatia. The SDG, as they were known, murdered, raped and pillaged their way across Yugoslavia. And yet Arkan was widely celebrated in Serbia for his patriotism. His powerful connections within the Yugoslavian government also kind of kept him from facing punishment for those crimes. Again, parallels with Wagner. As a result, he was really successful in politics. He was elected to parliament in 1992 and within a year had formed his own ultra-nationalist party called the Serbian Unity Party. I do wonder, you look at Vladimir Putin, if he doesn't reflect on figures like Arkan as cautionary tales for allowing folk heroes with aspirations to power to become too successful, too prominent until they can potentially topple them, and certainly the fate that befell the leaders of Wagner, the founders of Wagner, would suggest that he had. As regards the marriage itself, Tsetse and Arkan got married in 1995. We mentioned it was just had an abundance of Serbian tact in the ceremony. It combined Orthodox rituals. You mentioned earlier on, Mark, it combined multiple costume changes. There was a tiger-shaped wedding cake, and Tsetse performed at her own reception. Some see it, as I said, as being a symbolic marriage of popular culture and the state. There's that kind of metaphorical quality to it. And the video of the wedding was distributed for sale, and it was billed by the tabloids as a Serbian fairy tale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, part of Tsetse's ongoing prominence and success was due to financing from her husband. Her music and videos had the biggest budget of any in the genre. The state was certainly behind them, but so was Arkan. It was fairly well known, I think, where the money was coming from. She has some famous lyrics. There's a track called Cad B. Bio Ranyan. And it runs, if you were wounded, I would give you my blood, both my eyes if you were blind. And I think, whilst that's quite morally ambiguous, because, you know, she always said, that's just me talking about my love for my husband, it is within the context of, if you were wounded, I would give you my blood. You know, it's within the context of, my husband's a soldier, this is what he does, it's acknowledging that. She had a hit called Nia Montonia, it's not monotony. And that features tigers in the video, in fairly obvious reference to Arkan's group. Now, Arkan's death, he was indicted in the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, which is the ICTY, in 1997 on 24 counts of war crimes. And he was guilty of a lot more, let's be clear, but he was indicted in 24 counts, crimes against humanity, breaches of the Geneva Convention, but he never faced trial because he was assassinated in 2000 by a young police officer with ties to the criminal underground in the Balkans. He actually died in Tsetse's arms en route to hospital. I think she was shopping and he was outside when he was killed, and she came out and found him. Anyway, since then, Tsetse's a very interesting figure. Her career was unquestionably funded by the Serbian ethno-nationalist machine, and it was due to key figures like Arkan and like Slobodan Milosevic that she was able to rise to such heights in pop culture. And she vanished from the public spotlight immediately following Arkan's death, but she made a return in 2002 with a distinct new angle to her own personal narrative. The regime was dead, you know, Milosevic actually followed about 4 years later, but Tsetse had been nationalist adjacent, yet now recast herself as being entirely apolitical. Turbofolk itself at that moment was being scrutinised regularly for its connections to the war, and Tsetse was the queen of Turbofolk and she couldn't escape that same sort of scrutiny. Her replies to those kind of inquiries underlined this new narrative behind her brand. She said things like, quote, "I don't know what they're talking about. I don't sing songs about nationalism. I only sing about love. And besides, Milosevic has been gone for 4 years and I'm still here." That's clearly her in 2010 getting interviewed. Another quote, "I'm a huge patriot and no one has the right to take it away from me. I love my nation and my country." Now, Juroš Čvoro, the writer that we quoted quite a lot in the first couple of episodes, makes clear that her current music hinges on the theme of being a misunderstood and wrongly demonised woman whose only fault is being guided by her heart. Manta, 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 sve mi se manta kad vidite. Manta, 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 da li tebi manta se. She was interviewed for the Observer magazine in the UK in 2004 by a writer called Adam Higginbotham. The article was titled Arkan and Me, and he says, "In conversation, she likes to characterise herself as a tragic icon of Serbian womanhood, a God-fearing Christian who loves her children above all else, struggling bravely against injustice. She says, I am fragile and emotional. What doesn't kill me makes me stronger. Higginbotham goes on, I asked Cheche what people in Serbia think of her now. She says that I'm a victim of my name and my huge popularity and of my great love, that I was married to Zeljko. I'm not a criminal, I'm not a mafioso, I'm just a woman who's fighting her way through life. And when she's asked about Arkun, she's generally pretty careful. She says he was a great patriot. She says he's seen as a national hero, but he was misunderstood in Europe. She's asked interviewers, quote, do I look like someone who, being a young woman, being fragile, can be with someone who is a criminal and murderer to you? On stage in 2002, when that comeback, she dedicated the concert, which was a massive concert, to her husband Zeljko for Belgrade and for Serbia. And in a Serbian talk show, she responded to a question about his war crimes by saying, God help us in burning down the Hague Tribunal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's pretty staggering, because you would have to be incredibly fucking credulous to believe that Ceca had no idea what a fucking awful human being Arkun was, the awful things that he was responsible for, and where the money that paid for her career came from. It is so beyond the plausible, really. You know, you're in this kind of post-truth world where you're like, well, I suppose it's technically possible. There is no fucking way that that is possible. Yet, accordingly, our fan base seems to be primarily young women who, in the words of one writer, ignore Cheche's political connection and represent her as a strong woman who suffers but is able to overcome all of her personal grief and trauma. I mean, her branding has clearly worked. She still does very, very well, and a lot of people still listen to her regardless.
Millions and millions of plays on Spotify, releasing new records regularly. Yeah, she's still a well-known figure.
Yeah, what's amazing as well is it's not just her history that's problematic, because things haven't been quite so straightforward since she came back. In 2003, just a year after her comeback, she was arrested and held for 4 months in jail as part of an investigation into organised crime related to the murder of the Serbian Prime Minister Zoran Djindjic. Okay, she was later released uncharged, but she was certainly arrested and held for quite a while in connection to it. She was also arrested and pleaded guilty to a charge of illegal possession of firearms. She's actually sentenced to a year of house arrest and ordered to pay 1.5 million euros in fines. She also pled guilty to charges of misappropriating funds from the transfer of footballers from the club FC Obilić, which I think she was some sort of stakeholder in. Just as a final hurrah in Cheche, her son Veljko is a boxer who often tags his posts hashtag Tiger's Blood, clearly in a reference to his dad, and he almost always includes a Serbian flag in those captions. So Cheche is a fairly stunning figure and depiction of a sort of retrospective rewriting, denialism, distancing herself from the fairly horrendous roots of her fame. The part that even, I mean, in her lyrics, there's not a lot of really overtly incriminating stuff, that has to be said. But, I mean, I picked out a couple of examples of things that are a bit dodgy, but there is no fucking way. We, even over here, knew what Arkun did. She knew what this guy did. And that's her. That's her, like, living the rest of her life.
I mean, it's not 100%, you can't be 100% sure, but you could live in denial, you know, which is entirely possible. Right.
An astonishing amount of cognitive dissonance.
People are able to carry that, though, and they often do so for their entire lives.
You know, it's like the character of Tony Soprano's wife.
Yeah, totally. It's also like Donald Trump, who's clearly got massive cognitive dissonance over a lot of the shit that he has done and just completely refuses to even acknowledge, right?
Yeah.
And she can't escape it. She'll never escape it. And rightly so. She should never be able to escape it.
Yeah.
She'll be asked questions about it until she dies, and she'll know why she's been asked questions about it. And she's not completely fucking stupid, right?
No, clearly.
I think one thing that's probably quite worth noting is that she's not just tied to Turbo Folk because her husband was a nationalist and it was an organ of nationalism in the media, but also there's a whole lot of misogyny at play as well in Turbo Folk. and a lot of the women write songs that are very subservient to men, and still do to this day.
Yep, I think we'll go on to actually discuss the problematic messaging mm-hmm. and the dispute about its feminist credentials.
Yeah.
And that, look, we should mention a figure that's nowhere near as odious as Tetsa, Lippa Brenner. You know, Tetsa is the queen, but I think Lippa, she probably wouldn't like to be called the godmother or the grandmother, but she's the mother of turbo folk to some extent. Time Out magazine, for example, tells us Brenna is arguably the originator of the much-loved genre known as, in her town, Chaika. She sold over 40 million albums. She combined folk with contemporary pop and disco since the early 80s. She released that song we mentioned earlier on that challenged the linguistic divisions. Mm. I remember, it doesn't matter if it's sung or sung. That whole dispute that we said about dialects, she was trying to sort of bridge that. She's a Bosnian Muslim living in Belgrade and is married to a Serb, so she's got a more complicated ethnic background. She does, however, have a really famous video called Yugoslavenka. And it makes heavy use of nationalistic pride, sweeping shots of countryside, appeals to national nostalgia, that kind of thing. So strongly associated are her songs with the Yugoslavian era that for people that want to sort of leave that in the past, she's not always met with great warmth, which maybe explains the rarity of her visits to Croatia. But that said, when she did book to play in Zagreb, it sold out so fast that a second date was added almost instantly, like almost immediately.
Now, I think she's probably the most famous and most well known across the world as well. She regularly tour, or she used to regularly tour and just play gigs everywhere.
I think she's somewhat less controversial as well than Tetsa. Another couple of figures, one might be Helena Karaluša.
Yeah, she's really interesting, actually. She's quite an interesting person.
She's not the biggest name, but she's definitely worth mentioning because, first of all, she's the daughter of a Serbian army general. She started her career in the mid-90s. She had a relationship with a guy called Zoran Davidovic, who was nicknamed Kanda, who was murdered in a gangland killing in 2000. Mm.
Yeah, she's seen as being controversial due to the materialism, which is quite explicit in turbo folk. But also, she's quite open about sexuality, and she's apparently been seen as an advocate for female empowerment. But I mean, she challenged gender roles by flaunting her wealth, but that also rubs some feminists up the wrong way. Whilst obviously a lot of conservatives take issue with the fact that she talks about sex in general.
Yeah.
She's pro-LGBT. She's a champion of LGBT rights in Serbia.
We'll talk about the intersection with turbo folk and LGBTQ in the modern day. Yeah.
She's a vegetarian. She's very vocal on animal rights. She's been affiliated with PETA. Yeah, I mean, she's also supported quite a lot of
complex.
She's also supported quite a lot of liberal politicians over the years as well, you know. Yeah. So yeah, she's her music kind of really typifies the modern turbo folk aesthetic, mm-hmm. what it is now. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting that this kind of has moved out of this other sphere.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
But black metal have done the same thing.
That's true. Getting towards the end of maybe the prominent people to mention, Ivan Gavrilovich wrote a famous song which translates as 200 miles per hour. I'm not great at saying it. Is it Dvesta Nasad? This is 1994. It's famous and fairly archetypal turbo folk because, you know, it's a little bit hard to distinguish it from what you might call Eurodance, but it's got this burst of accordion that really, you know, sets it apart. And that was kind of the thing with turbo folk, you know, in terms of formula. You had a lot of Eurodance influences coming in, but then they always included these bouzoukis and accordions and fiddles and things that were like much more rural and traditional. That track, 200 Miles Per Hour, came out at the same time, 1994, at the same time as massacres were taking place in, you know, the likes of Croatia, the likes of Bosnia-Herzegovina, and had lyrics about wanting to get out of this town. It did have a sense of escapism. It wasn't so overtly odious in its subject matter.
I think in the first couple of episodes, I mentioned a couple of times an outlet called Pink TV, which is very important to mention because they were basically, as I've alluded to, the state organ. They were the MTV that was pushing this to the youth and all that time. It kind of monopolised the media space and played a crucial propaganda role under Milosevic's regime. His wife, Miranya, she owned it. And they really played a huge part in sort of pushing that hyper-materialistic, hedonistic lifestyle. And all the values of the regime's new Serbian elite were also as part of this. You know, the war profiteers, the politicians, the criminals-turned-businessmen, all of that came across as being just as glamorous as the turbo folk stars themselves that were getting pushed on the channel. Yeah. A lot of the iconography and the imagery used in Pink TV were actually pioneered by a photographer called Dijan Milicevic, who promoted materialistic displays of wealth through expensive cars, gold jewellery and skimpy clothing. If you go and watch some of the videos of these artists, the imagery will not look won't look too strange to you because you'll have seen it across Western media from, you know, it's not a new thing. But that brazen visual aesthetic was aligned with turbo folk's valorisation of crime, violence and Serbian chauvinism and its complete disregard of morality. Another person that played quite a big role was S.J. Zeal, who was a photographer, and he also was responsible for like creating the erotic depictions of the female stars. So Milosevic and Zeal were both like really responsible for creating that image, which was then put on Pink TV, Serbian MTV, which then the youth latch onto that as something that they can really go for.
I mean, it's amazing that the closeness of the connection between Milosevic, his wife, you know, Pink TV, direct line to the top of the government. This is the agenda. You're going to help me make it happen. Her saying, I need you to do this to help me with this. Him saying, what do you need me to do? Just the ability, the ease with which they were able to facilitate that crossover, because it was literally a married couple communicating to each other. I mean, it probably explains the astronomical rise of it as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the money's there. The organ for it is there. It's just easy to get that in front of people. And you know, there's going to be a little bit of Western culture that are creeping in, you know, that there's that glamour and all that, which will probably be coming off on TV as well, probably not as much. So I think by them aligning with what was a well-known Western aesthetic, it's quite a powerful tool, you know. Yeah. In the last episode, we quoted some of the quite kitsch sounding and really not at all sexualized or glamorous patriotic war songs, but they were either happening at the same time or they were just years away from being there.
Yeah.
You know, the line is there.
Absolutely. And in terms of some of the most odious output, I mean, like Pink TV glammed it up. It glossed over it. It created an environment of permissibility. Mm. You know, it helped blur the edges of it. I think to finish this section, I'd like to just highlight a probably for me the most grim example of the genre by a band called Ultra Clan Terrorista. Adam, you came across this one. The title of the song is Kosovo is Serbia, which is means Kosovo is Serbia. So immediately alludes to that sort of pseudo-historical thing that we spoke about in part two. Kosovo is Serbia is also the title of a film from around about this time as well, I believe. And I guess this really sums up that 90s chapter for me. All of these figures from the kind of fairly benign, from the almost the positive, and the likes of Romeo, what's his name?
Amadeus.
Yeah, Amadeus, through to Tsetsa, through to Helena. I think Ultra Clan Terrorista really encapsulate that sort of grim, fascinating part of the 90s. Here's some lyrics from this song. The plan for tonight is to cross their border. You make them a slaughterhouse out of houses and villages. Slaughter the shippers, kill the Wahhabis. Whoever protests should be impaled. I see them crying, I say enough is enough. Throw all the women and children off the bridge. No more forgiveness. You see the house, it's on fire. For each of our churches, your mosques will pay us. Kalashnikov bombs, three fingers high. Three fingers being a Serbian sort of symbol, like a kind of patriotic salute. Let them kneel when they see Jesus from the cross. One was Arkan's guard. Rima Maniac, brutal tyranny. I mean, it sounds like a fucking metal song at this point. A real disaster. Let Albania disappear. Long live Serbia. I kill for Serbia. In order to take off the Diana, you fucked goats. They raped the sisters, all in the name of the lineage. You are gone, you disgusting creatures, for the future of Serbia and its generations. And that track was popular. That really encapsulates the fucking hatred, the venom that went on in some of the music of this era. And I guess we're edging towards the contemporary. We're getting towards now. I think there's just one more stop off I want to make before we get to what the fuck is going on with Turbo Folk right now. And it's a thing called Yugo Nostalgia. It was an ongoing phenomenon in the various states, not just Serbia, in fact, far from just Serbia, that were left after the dissolution of Yugoslavia. And it was clearly, you can get it from the name, characterised by pining for the aspects of lost Yugoslav identity, and to some extent, like the security of life under Tito, his ability to suppress all the nationalism, relative peace, you know, at a price, clearly, under an authoritarian regime. Even just things like kitsch Yugoslav culture. I mean, there's aspects of Yugoslav culture are quite in demand out with Yugoslavia. It's a very kitschy time. And there are some examples in terms of music that have sort of endured. One would be Bijelo Dugme. Right, so this is a band, Bijelo Dugme, that they're a really good example. They were formed in 1974 in Sarajevo. The name actually translates as White Button. Their reunion in Belgrade in 2005 has become one of the highest attended concerts of all time in the world. The Yugoslav rock scene, you know, it existed despite the authoritarian state. It was there. Bijelo Dugme were easily one of the most popular and generally well thought of, particularly in hindsight. They had a fusion of Balkan trad sounds with modern rock, and it is seen in some way as paving the way for Turbo Folk. I don't think that's an accolade they're particularly delighted about. They disbanded in 1989, so prior to the major armed conflicts, and thus they never really directly reckoned with things like performing outside of their home state in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Regardless, they remained, and they do remain now, quite popular across the Balkan states, and obviously that's in parallel with the likes of Tsetsa. Another one that I would mention is Rani Mraz. Or, in solo guise, Georgi Balasevich, or Balashevich. Nikad nisam bio momak oko kog se diže larma, ali mislim da sam faca i da imam nekog šarma. Možda grešim, ali ja sam takvog dojma. Neki kažu da sam led, a neki kažu da sam vatra. I actually mentioned him briefly earlier on. So Rani Mraz was another act of the 70s Yugoslav scene. They formed around 77. They actually had a hit with Računate Nanaz. Sumnjaju neki da nosi nas pogrešan tok, jer slušamo ploče i sviramo rok, ali negde u
kaplam i kažem vam šta dobro znam, računajte na nas.
Which I think means count on us, described by some of the press as an anthem of a generation.
Mm-hmm.
From that band emerged the solo career of Djordje Balašević, and he had a 1982 album called Pub, which produced a load of hits, actually. I think the name Pub translates as Jack, and that included a track called Lepa Protina Chi.
Još sam bio sasvim mlad, neke barske ptice sam lovio tad, kad je došla da se kupa lepa protina kći.
Fucking translation of this track name, Archpriest's Beautiful Daughter. What the fuck? Djordje was born in Serbia to a family that was part Hungarian and part Croat, and he, as a result, he was a testament to the interconnectedness of the Slavic and Balkan people. Accordingly, after acquiring considerable fame, he became a really prominent anti-war voice throughout the conflicts. Big opponent to Milosevic as well. Even in the late 80s, he preempted the coming wars by criticising and lamenting growing ethnic tension on stage publicly, frequently. He was the first Serbian performer to appear in Sarajevo after the siege of Sarajevo. As I say, he was an outspoken opponent of Milosevic at great personal risk to himself. And he was also appointed as the new UNHCR Goodwill Ambassador for the region in 1996 for his efforts.
Wow.
So there were interesting things going on in Yugoslav music, despite the suppression, you know, prior to Tito's death, prior to Milosevic arriving. And some of them did endure as well. And what also endured was, in some senses, a wish to forget that period of horror and maybe a slightly misplaced but forgivable nostalgia for the Yugoslavia that came before that shit show erupted. But in terms of 21st century change broadly, before we start looking at the role of turbo folk right now, that writer that I talked about earlier on, Paul Hockinos, he wrote that article for In These Times, issue 25. He talks about how the Balkans, and especially Serbia, began to renew, and in particular through the efforts of young people, student organisations, following the end of Milosevic's regime. Here's a passage of what he wrote. In terms of culture, nothing new was born in the last 7 years. Those are the words of Natasha Milojevic, a professional journalist and activist in the Progressive Social Democratic Party. And she continues, but now minds and ideas are free again to express themselves publicly. Among musicians, artists, painters, our rock and roll culture has been reborn. In Milosevic's Serbia, alternative rock bands were dropped from state-run airways. The once vibrant club scene banished to isolated niches. Groups like the punkish KUD Idioti from Croatia or Slovenian provocateurs Leibach wouldn't consider playing Serbia, even if they could have received visas or venues to perform. The same went for artists, theatre groups and film companies. A major catalyst in the urban renaissance and a critical factor in the overthrow of Milosevic was a student movement. The underground youth organisation Otpor, which translates to resistance, combined pop culture and politics, guerrilla tactics and youthful verve to mobilise thousands of young people and older people across Serbia. Otpor's brash anti-regime slogans and non-violent theories of resistance took opposition from the cities to the countryside, the bedrock of Milosevic's support. Under Otpor's icon, which is like a simple stenciled black fist, the group pushed the message that every individual act of resistance was part of a nationwide movement. It's quite a positive and optimistic thing that the change, even what brought down Milosevic, largely came from below, largely came from the youth, largely came from an attempt to remodernise a society that had been dragged backwards or more accurately frozen in time. And he continues, though funded by foreign governments, which is interesting, including the United States, as well as the Serbian diaspora, Otpor's influences are closer to home. The World War II partisans, the 60s student protesters in Yugoslavia, and the 80s Neue Slovenische Kunst movement, which was a group of iconoclast artists from Slovenia. And there's also a good dose of the anarchistic, rebellious energy of punk rock in Otpor, but without a Malcolm McLaren or a Johnny Rotten, because Otpor is leaderless and anti-hierarchical. And that was a key to having successfully avoided the dragnet of Milosevic's secret police and, as the kids put it, a natural response to a lifetime of a leadership cult. So you had this generation of young people absolutely horrified by this cult of the strong man, and a guy who did routinely purge movements that he saw as a threat, but they found a way to get round that by not having heads of their organisation. It's fucking brilliant, frankly. And even though there were a lot of factors that contributed to the downfall of Milosevic, that was a huge one, and it was internal, and it grew from natural frustration, the inability to keep a population completely under your thumb. So it's quite a hopeful note to end side C on, man. We'll come back in side D and we will learn about where Turbo Folk is now, what it is now, what it's come to represent to people, and maybe what we can expect in the near future, because spoiler alert, it's not all fixed down there.
See you next episode.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.